was relapsums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 138 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. Coming to you from Boise, Idaho, I am Andrew Brokus, joined by Carlos Welch and Nate Mavis. Where are you guys?
I'm in Somerville. Where are you, Carlos? Sorry.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Your answer is more interesting. I wanted to get my boring answer out of the way first. And more specifically, in Atlanta, Georgia, where are you?
I am in the Knit Cage, which is my poker office.
Yeah, so the big Carlos news here, for those who haven't heard already, is you've become, what, even more homeless than you already were. You'd been living in the places that, like, business people stay when they're in extended stay type places.
Business people is a stretch, unless you mean drug dealers. extended stay hotels. So, you know, actually, now that I think about it, there's probably like two different classes of those type of places. So there probably are some where business people actually stay, but I stay in the other end of the spectrum where street pharmacists
can't scrape
stay.
Together enough money to pay a month's rent in advance, the places where those people stay.
Exactly.
So anyway, that's no longer your home. What's your current setup?
My current home, my new address is 2005 Chrysler Town and Country Drive, which is the 2005 minivan that I bought to live in.
So what motivated that?
Just for the past couple of years, I initially ran across an article about a musician that lived in an RV. And I want to say the headline of the article caught my attention because it said that this guy lives, his expenses are $11,000 a year. I'm thinking, how does he do that? And so, of course, that got me to click on the article, and they talked about him living in an RV. And so he was a musician, I think making like $35,000 a year. And with all the extra money, he was basically investing and saving for retirement, and was able to grow his nest egg a lot faster than people that were not doing what he was doing. So that always caught my attention. That's been in the back of my mind for a while. And after Vegas this year, my initial plan was to go back to the extended stays like I've been doing before. But I was thinking about getting on Twitch. And I felt like, because of all the great poker players on Twitch and, so many people are basically just have like, you know, the skillful poker player market cornered on Twitch. So I figured like, you know, I needed an angle, and I was like, man, I could do the RV thing. Well, not RV. I could, do the living in a van thing, because that's an angle that only I could bring to Twitch. So part of it was kind of like a gimmicky thing to get some attention on Twitch. And the other part of it is, you know, just being in a position that I'm able to do it, you know, being single and having no kids seems like a smart idea to save a ton of money.
You mentioned your inspiration for this was in an RV. And when you first told me you were going to do this, I assumed you meant moving into like a conversion van. Why did you choose a minivan?
The reason I chose the minivan is because, number one, I could get one for cheaper.
Right.
I bought this van.
I assumed that was the main reason.
Yeah. So I bought the van for $3,000 cash, and RV and a camper van would have been a little bit more expensive. And I have to say camper van, because some people were confused when I say RV. They thought I meant like one of those big $50,000 to $100,000 bus looking things that are parked outside of the Rio during the WSOP. That's never been on my radar. But I wanted to go cheaper than a camper van, and also because I'll be traveling to live events to in the van. I wanted something with better gas mileage, and camper vans don't get very good gas mileage.
And it's comfortable enough sleeping in the minivan?
Yes, yes. I don't need a ton of space, and so for what I need, it is perfect.
Did you sell your motorcycle?
No, my motorcycle is actually parked inside of my mother's house.
Inside?
Yeah, yeah. Because I initially was going to leave it in my grandmother's backyard, but she was afraid somebody would steal it. And the way my mother's place is set up, like you come in, you open the front door, and there's like a lobby area, for lack of a better term, and then you go upstairs to where the living area is. And so that space downstairs, she said I could just put it in there, so I did. And that's where it will be sitting until I'll likely sell it, but that's where it is right now.
So logistically, I assume one of the bigger challenges is finding a place where you can park the van and sleep overnight.
It's not that hard, and that's because, like, when I told you when I learned about the guy, the musician that was doing it, they kind of sparked me to go on YouTube and find other people that were doing it. And so I've learned a lot about the logistics. Like, there's tons of people doing this all across the world. And so one of the things I learned is that big box stores like Walmart and Home Depot, I call them hobo friendly. So they don't mind if you park in their parking lots overnight. And so that's normally where I go.
The Nick Cave that you mentioned is, this is like one of those office sharing type things that you've rented so that you don't have to be sitting in your van in the middle of Atlanta summer during the day?
That is the reason I have it, but it's not an office sharing thing. It's kind of hard to explain. Like, it's not the type of offices that like businessmen would use. It's basically like a glorified flea market. That's the best way I can describe it. So like the shops around me aren't normal, like office shops, you know? So I'm really having a hard time figuring out how to describe this place. There's not like a receptionist or anything like that. Like there's no building wide Wi-Fi or telephone service or anything like that. So it's basically like, you know, a flea market.
How do you even find a place like that?
The same way I find everything else in my life, Craigslist. So this place was for rent $200 a month. And before, when I was staying at it, in the extended stays, they were costing me about $200 a week. So that's a huge savings right there.
Now, I was thinking initially, I know that you're showering at Planet Fitness, and I thought maybe you had access to a kitchen as part of this, what I thought was an office share, but I'm assuming that's not the case?
That is not the case. What I have is a dorm-style refrigerator in the office with me. There is like a bathroom that's like a common bathroom, but no common kitchen area.
What are you doing then for food?
Fresh fruits and vegetables. I don't do any cooking. Well, I should say fresh fruits and vegetables and junk food like Oreos. So nothing that I eat on my own needs to be cooked. Any cooked food I eat when I'm going to, like, you know, cash games or, you know, if I'm out with friends at some restaurant.
You've been doing this for how long now?
Since I got back from Vegas, so like 3 weeks. And so far, I'm absolutely loving it.
Yeah, it hasn't, like, have there been unpleasant surprises?
Okay, so the one, and I may speak a little bit softer on this part because the other people around me could probably hear me. But when I initially came to see the manager about getting the place, I told him that I wanted an area that was kind of quiet. And so he pointed me to the office that I'm currently in. And at the time I got here, it was pretty quiet. But since then, two other shops have taken up empty space across the hall. And sometimes it's a little bit more noisy than I would like. So So far that's my only gripe.
I'm impressed. I think you kind of mentioned in passing when we were in Las Vegas, the idea of like moving into a van. It didn't seem like you had, and we didn't really talk about it. I didn't get the impression. It seemed like just an idea you were kind of like kicking around in your head, not something you were like days away from executing on when you mentioned it to me. How much research had you done before you started, before you bought the van?
You mean in terms of finding a van or in terms of like living this lifestyle?
Yeah, just like figuring out, I don't know, like I would assume there would be a bunch of things that would come up that it wouldn't just, you know, you've lived in a house or an apartment or something your entire life. And there's probably a lot of things you kind of like take for granted. And then you're like, oh, right, I don't have access to running water. I don't have access to, you know, is there stuff like that just like came up?
So the research for that part of it, I've been doing for years, like, back when I first learned about the musician. And a friend of mine also pointed me towards an article about a Major League Baseball player that's basically doing the same thing. He lives in a van and he's like a millionaire. And so I've been reading these stories for a while and I pretty much understand a lot of the what it entails.
He's been preparing for this whole life, Andrew.
yeah, you know, this is a dream come true for me. I used to tell people that my goals in life were to be homeless, jobless, and alone, and I finally reached that goal. there hasn't been anything like comforts of home that I've missed. Like I said, I do have running water in the bathroom down the hall. I got my refrigerator. And if I wanted to cook some stuff, I could put a microwave in here, but I just don't personally eat a lot of cooked food anyway. I actually have more amenities by doing this than I had before. Like I didn't have a gym at the hotel that I stayed in. I got access to like 15 treadmills to look at as I walk in to take a shower. It's not like I'm going to use them a ton, but I have used them a couple of times. Sometimes I'll go and I'll watch daytime Jeopardy while walking on the treadmill. I also have access to like 10 high def flat screen TVs now that I didn't have before, all for $20 a month.
How about safety wise? I mean, do you have concerns about just kind of sleeping out in the open, where, you know, probably people could realize that you're in, you know, that there's a person in that van when they see it parked in a parking lot?
No, I don't have any concerns safety wise, and it's all it goes back to what I used to say about, you know, walking around with money in my pocket in Vegas. I'm not the typical victim for a situation like that. If I was like a small female, I probably would not be doing this, but not too many people will walk by and see me in there and decide to, you know, mess with me. So far it's been fine. And I'm not in there with like jewelry hanging off my neck or like bags of cash visually. I mean, how many people go up to like, yeah, let me go rob this homeless guy that's sleeping in his van? Like, not too many people have that thought.
Well, no, not necessarily rob, but just like mess with. I mean, I think that is kind of a problem for actual homeless people, people who are literally out on the streets, just that like some drunk person will decide to mess with them, or, you know, a group of guys leaving at a bar will be like, oh, hey, let's kick this guy's ass. Or I mean, I'm not trying to give you things to be afraid of, but I guess my chief concerns would be either just not some person necessarily trying to rob you as much as just like mess with you because he knows like, oh, hey, there's a person living in that van. Let's mess with him. Or the police giving you a hard time would be my other concern.
The police thing is probably, that would be like the one thing that I'm anticipating that will eventually happen. To me, that's more of a concern. I was not aware that homeless people have to worry about people messing with them like that. That's not something that I've personally seen, but I guess that makes sense.
As much as people like have concern about, oh, there's homeless people sleeping in my area, that's going to cause crime. Like, there's far more incidents, I think, of non-homeless people committing violent crime against homeless people than vice versa.
I guess that does make sense. One way that I guess I mitigate that is by being in, like, the back of the van has like tinted windows, and I'm eventually gonna even get like blackout curtains that I can put on there, and if push comes to shove, I'll just get in the front seat and drive off. you know that's the one good thing about, you know, being mobile.
Sorry, what were you starting to say about the police?
A lot of guys that do this on YouTube videos, they'll do, you know, they'll put up videos about, you know, the police coming knocking on their window and asking them why they're there and basically giving them a hard time. So I expect that to eventually happen. If you go to a place like a Walmart or a Home Depot in certain areas, it's not the case everywhere, but in certain areas, if you ask them permission, they will allow you to stay there. But even still, some places have like local ordinances against that type of stuff. So I'm expecting issues like that. I mean, just, you know, any type of anything that looks out of ordinary will attract police attention. So I'm definitely anticipating that at some point.
Is there a community of people? Like, I mean, it sounds like you're kind of concentrating at a Home Depot or a Walmart or something. Are you meeting other people who are doing the same thing?
No, I'm not currently, because there's not a lot of people in this particular area that do that. There's a lot of, well, I say a lot, that term is relative. There are several people on YouTube that are doing this, but they're not concentrated in particular areas. And so I'll probably eventually, if, you know, the whole Twitch thing, and maybe I'll do YouTube videos, if that stuff gets popular, I'll probably like network with some of the other people that are doing this on YouTube that are pretty popular. But as far as this local area, I haven't met anybody else that does it. Maybe I should start a blog called thinkinghobo.com or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite common not quite common, but like, I mean, I see people pretty much every day in San Francisco, especially in the neighborhood where I live. There are people. I think the laws are kind of changing quickly, or the public tolerance is changing quickly in San Francisco for, RVs or vans parked on the side of the street that people are clearly living in, but you still see them just parked different places around the city, and especially like quieter parts of the city, it seems to be more or less okay. And there's kind of a long history of people doing that in San Francisco. But and when I was in Vancouver also, I spotted a few RVs that people were pretty clearly living in just parked on the side of the road. So it doesn't strike me as that uncommon of a thing, but I think your reasons for doing it are pretty different than most people's. Or your, right. Maybe not even exactly your reasons, but kind of your overall plan.
Right. I will say in my research that I did come across more people doing it in places like San Francisco than in Atlanta. So I will say that if there was any place where there's a concentration of people doing it, San Francisco would probably be like, you know, a hotbed for this type of activity.
And I actually mentioned in the when I brought us in that I'm in Boise right now, and I'm actually, it's a bit of a long story, but my girlfriend and I are en route to a meetup with some people that she used to work with. She worked at a mountain bike tour company. She was doing like PR type stuff for them, but she got to know a lot of the people who are mountain bike tour guides, and the company was based out of Las Vegas. And a fair number of the people who are going to be at this kind of reunion for people who work there were, and to some extent still are, kind of like mountain bike bums, where essentially they kind of just want to mountain bike. they want to bike all the time, and so all that. But they have kind of like basic human needs like shelter that they have to provide. And so it's similar to you, like they're just kind of trying to say what's the absolute cheapest way I can live, because you don't make a lot of money as a mountain bike guide. What's like the absolute cheapest way that I can live so that I can spend as much time as humanly possible riding my mountain bike and still and so like these are people who have lived in vans. The main difference from you, I think, is that they're often doing it in far more rural places. So if you're like, especially out west, there's a lot of land that belongs to the I guess it's the Forestry Service, like National Forests, I think, for the most part, or the Bureau of Land Management, that kind of stuff. Right. You can kind of just camp anywhere, like unless like it specifically says that you can't. You can just like go on national forest land. It doesn't have to be like a designated camping spot. Like you can just kind of set up pretty much anywhere as long as you know how to, you know, do like a leave no trace sort of thing, which, you know, national parks is different. But for the more unmanaged national land, which there's plenty of out west, you can just kind of set up wherever. And that's where they want to be. Mountain biking anyway, so I think it was somewhat easier for them to there was like a more natural setup for them.
Right. Yeah, this is definitely more prevalent in rural areas, and like, you know, that a lot of people in those areas have more of this off the grid mentality. But, you know, just being in the city, like I'm definitely a weirdo around here for doing this. Whereas I would probably fit right in some of the areas that you mentioned.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to telling more people about you once I see them. There's one couple that we're staying with right now, and they have, they actually own a house in Boise that they kind of bought when it was in really bad shape, and have fixed it up a lot and whatnot. But they do also have a van that they use when they go camping, that they've done a lot of work to turn it into, it already was a camper van, but they've kind of built a lot of things themselves to make it, you know, really sort of ideal for their purposes. I might even try to get a few pictures of it for you, just to, so you can see the setup that they have. It's something they've put a lot of work into.
Yeah, you know what? If you go online, YouTube, and just like the, I guess the catch-all phrase would be like van dwellers, and if you just search that online, you'll see like some people got some nice ass like really elaborate setups, and I may eventually do that. But because I'm only using it part-time, like most of the time I'm in my office. And so I basically only use it for, like, I will do Twitch streams from the van, and also I'll sleep in the van. But other than that, I'm not in there full-time. So I haven't really set it up as nicely as a lot of these people have. But if I decide to go that route in the future, I will set it up more like, you know, really nice. And then also I may actually get, you know, a bigger, like a camper van. And like, there's one guy, and I want to say he's based out of Vancouver. And man, his setup is so nice. He's got like a fireplace. He's got like a queen size bed, and like, it's super nice, man. And I'm thinking like his van looks nicer than any apartment I've ever stayed in. So
Eventually,
I may go that route.
The bed reminds me of one other question, which is, I imagine, romantically, this might not be the most appealing place to, you know, to bring a date.
That's true. And part of the appeal of doing this for me is the amount of money I'm saving, which
you can rent a hotel.
Gives me ample funds for like a good hotel room, not like the crackhead places that I normally live, but like, you know, something somewhat nice.
I still think that, I mean, at some point you're gonna have to say, and I guess this is just, you know, what it means to date Carlos, you got to be up for this sort of thing, but you know, you have to say, I do live in a van. Like, that's got to be a pretty big stumbling block on date three for you to drop that bomb.
Luckily for me, I'm not really interested in like long-term relationships or kids or any of that grown-up shit. So when things get serious to the point where I have to, you know, decide to, I guess, choose not to do the things like this that I actually want to do because of somebody else's preferences, then it's time for me to distance myself from that person.
It's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
How's trying to play your A game under new conditions? You know, some people some people find it easier to play as well as possible when, like, after they've moved or after they've had some life change, you know, they find that hitting the reset button in some sense is really healthy. Some people find it a lot harder to play their A game. So you've got all this different stuff going on and you're taking care of van logistics, et cetera. How easy is it to play your absolute best?
You know what? The living conditions hasn't affected me at all. What has affected me is twitching. So I'm trying to get the technology together, which I'm not good at, you know, getting the video to come out the way it needs to look. And so I'm trying to, you know, deal with behind the scenes technical stuff. I'm trying to entertain the people in chat, tell stories, and all that stuff is causing me to probably play my E game. And so that's why I only do it like on one table, and I'll play like at some stakes that aren't that serious to me. Because there's no way, until I get used to this, there's no way I'm going to be able to become like a Twitch, you know, entertainer and focus on my A game at the same time. But if I'm not running the stream, then the other stuff doesn't bother me at all. I'm able to play my A game off stream, even from the van.
I was surprised a couple times that I got on stream how non-intuitive it was. I mean, I thought I've got experience making videos, so in terms of just talking and playing, which I agree it's a big challenge and it's something I struggled with a lot when I first started doing that, but you know, I've been making videos for a long time now. So I kind of thought streaming was going to be pretty similar, but yeah, there's quite a few. I don't know, I didn't find Twitch very like user-friendly from the streamer side of things in terms of, you know, how to get everything set up. And I know you had a few hiccups on your first stream, and I did a couple of times that I tried to do it. I don't think it ever went 100% smoothly.
Yeah, it's such a pain, man. It is not user-friendly. And on top of that, I'm using like Wi-Fi hotspots off of my cell phone. And I got an old laptop that is not, you know, the best it could be. And so I got hardware issues, I got internet issues, and then on top of that, the software that you use to actually broadcast on Twitch is, you know, a clunker of a piece of software. So you got all that stuff combined with the fact that I'm sitting in a hot ass van trying to, you know, get it all together. So that's been, you know, an issue for me. And also, now this came up the other day, I have a like a separate battery in the van that I use to charge my laptop and run the fan and all that stuff while I'm doing. And so the noise from the inverter, or sometimes they're called converters, which is basically a contraption that I attach to the battery, which allows me to plug in my laptop. Fan noise from that was drowning out my voice, and there's a lot of technical issues from every angle by me doing it the way I'm doing that I have to get figured out and sorted out in the next couple of streams to kind of get this thing where I want it to be.
And what's your name on Twitch, or your Twitch address for people who want to start following you on there?
twitch.tv/CarlosWelch.
So earlier you said that Twitch felt a little bit too much like a job for you. So what's different now? So you've got all these software, hardware issues. Presumably it still has some of the job-like disadvantages. What's really motivating you to do Twitch?
That was one of the reasons why I didn't initially want to do it. And so I'm kind of, like, I kind of talk myself into doing, you know what, the main reason why I eventually decided to do it was this whole running joke that we have where I was on somebody else's Twitch stream the other day. I mean, not the other day, like before Vegas. And somebody saw my name in Twitch and said, "Wait, are you the Carlos Welch?" And so that happened on Twitch. And then when I went out to Vegas, there were a lot of people that met me in person that kind of had that same or similar reaction. Like, there was one guy that kind of walked past me when I was having a conversation with Killenberg, one of the owners of TPE. And this guy recognized my voice from the podcast and asked me if I was Carlos. So I got all this unwarranted attention in Vegas this year, and I was like kind of conflicted, thinking that, like, you know, I'm nobody, man. I'm not some famous poker player or, you know, professional. So that combined with the need to develop some type of passive income kind of made me think, well, if I'm getting all this attention, not because I'm like, you know, one of the good, like super good poker players, it's because I'm like the, you know, opposite. I call it the anti-baller. And so I was like, that's something I can bring to Twitch, whereas somebody like a Jason Somerville or, you know, Daniel Negreanu wouldn't be able to bring to Twitch. And so as far as it being like a job, that's still something that I'm kind of worried about. But to me, this kind of validates the attention that I've been getting. Like, this is what I bring to the table.
I was thinking, it's funny, given that you have greatly increased your bankroll in the last couple of months, and I know you've had at least slightly profitable summer in Las Vegas. Most people, you know, poker players and maybe even people in general, would like upgrade their standard of living after, like, oh, finally I've making some money from poker and now I can move into a bigger house or I can buy a nicer car. And, you know, it seems, I guess you're not even really downgrading your style of life because you weren't living under ritzy conditions before. But I just think it's sort of funny that you're like, okay, finally I can, you know, get rid of my apartment and move into a van.
Yeah. You know what? My thought when I make all this money, my thought is, oh shit, I got this huge lump of cash. How can I not give it back? And so, you know, the more money I make, the less money I want to spend because I can't replace it. If I lose it, you know, how likely would it be for me to ship the, you know, Bovada Major again? You know, when I only had a couple of $1,000, it would only take, you know, a month or two of tutoring or substitute teaching to replace that. But the role that I have now, I can't replace that easily. And so I'm trying to hold on to it as best as I can. And, you know, basically do everything in my power to not blow it. And this is something that I have the ability to do. So I figured, you know, why not?
I respect that.
And just for everybody out there, can I put in a quick plug for Carlos's Twitch channel? I think it's really well suited to Carlos, a bit like this podcast. It's not like television. It's long form, and it gives you a chance to talk about things sort of at the length and in the style that you would want to. Like, you're not really a soundbite kind of guy, and I think Twitch is a good medium for you. I like the channel, and I think it's like I think the format is very well suited to you. So I enjoy it.
Thank you. Now, I'll also say this. This is something I've been kind of kicking around in the back of my head. And this is probably less about Twitch, poker, but just this whole van idea. A lot of people from where I grew up and a lot of other places in America, or all over the world, actually, you know, a lot of people don't have a lot of money. And so you end up trying to, I guess, keep up with the Joneses, and that causes a lot of people to do things that they shouldn't do to get money. And I think if we had this whole mentality of like cutting expenses by doing crazy shit like this, I think that will kind of cut down on a lot of people, you know, chasing dollars illegally, or, you know, whatever else, or even just like, you know, stressing themselves out with jobs that they hate. And so I kind of like the idea of coming to the realization that you don't need all the things that society tells you that you need to be happy. Like, I say this basically every day on Twitch. I say that I used to own a 2-story house with 4 bedrooms, 3 baths. So I had, so this was in 2009 when I bought the house. It's like, you know, I was approaching what I always learned as a kid was the American dream. But I'm way happier now than I was when I, you know, had all that stuff. So the the way I'm cutting stress by doing this is probably one of the biggest appeals to it for me. And I think that's something that if a lot of people thought outside of the box like that, then they could kind of, you know, live a more simple, happier life.
At the risk of giving you an overly big head here, which you don't generally seem to be in too much danger of, I mean, I think the role that you're fulfilling with the whole van thing and with a lot of other things that you've done in your life and in your poker career, I guess part of what I find interesting about you is I feel like you're kind of fulfilling the function that like an artist plays for a society, where you're kind of pushing the limits a little bit of what's possible, or kind of suggesting other ways of living or other ways of doing things. And it's not through, you know, what's traditionally thought of as like an artistic medium, right? You're not like writing or painting or something. That's not your primary mode of communication. But, you know, you're sort of demonstrating like, hey, you know, you don't have to do these things in exactly the way that most people do them, or the way that we're sort of you know, taught to do them, or the kind of received wisdom about what life is supposed to look like. And I think that's one of the things that's most interesting about you, and a big part, you know, when we first met you, which I guess was a little over 2 years ago now in Las Vegas, and, you know, heard your interview on Tournament Poker Edge, and why I initially was like, oh, wow, this guy's really interesting, was just that idea of being able to just think outside of the box, which I think, you know, I think for a lot of people, like, doesn't even occur to them to do things differently. And so I think, you know, we need people like you reminding us, you know, hey, there's other ways of doing things, and you don't have to just kind of swallow all the received wisdom. So thank you.
Right, right. Yeah, you know what? Thank you. Yeah, you're right. I'm basically like the Henry David Thoreau of poker. And so, yeah, you know, this van, the Knitmobile, that's my Walden Pond. So yeah, it's good to be mentioned with the greats.
Anything else we want to talk about with regard to this, or should we switch into a strategy mode?
Quickly, I will say this: by not spending my money on a mortgage or even a hotel room or any of that other stuff, I'm able, like a lot of people will get, so like, for example, my Twitch stream is titled Homeless Poker Player. And so a lot of time people will get in there and they'll say, are you really homeless? If you're homeless, how can you afford a computer? How can you afford all this stuff? And I'm thinking, I'm homeless in the sense that I don't live in a house, but I'm not poor. In fact, I'm living way below my means. I could afford to get all that stuff if I wanted to, but I just don't want it and I don't need it. And so that frees up a lot of money that I can use to invest in mutual funds and, you know, in my retirement and even in my poker bank role. And so by living this way now, it's going to afford me much more security in the future and into, like, you know, my retirement years than somebody that is, you know, living a quote unquote better, more, I guess, a nicer standard of living right now. But a lot of the people that are living that way aren't saving for retirement. So there's a huge financial benefit to doing this beyond just, you know, my present financial situation. This is going to put me in a position in the future that I wouldn't be able to be in otherwise.
Well, Carlos is a great source of lifestyle strategy advice. Definitely encourage you to check out his Twitch stream and learn some more about how he's living his life. And definitely keeping your expenses down is one important component of being all but the most elite professional poker players. But if you are looking to upgrade your card playing skill, Tournament Poker Edge is the place to go, and also a place where you can meet and hang out with Carlos. Nice side benefit there from Tournament Poker Edge. But you'll also get access to dozens of instructors, hundreds of hours of videos teaching you how to play better tournament poker in all of its forms. Be sure to check that out at tournamentpokeredge.com. So a couple strategy things, and I might hopefully kick this off with a shorthand, but as part of this trip that I'm on right now, Emily and I stayed overnight in Reno on our way from San Francisco to Idaho, which is interesting. I'd never been. Have you been to Reno before, Nate?
Yeah, I really like it. It was beautiful, and I visited back when the Peppermill had a fantastic 5-10 game, like a really, really good 5-10 game. It was like a bunch of friendly folks who didn't play as well as I did, frankly, and scenery was good, the air was fresh, there was a good Indian place I went to, cheap, and the action was fantastic, and I think very well of the place. I think it's different now, but that's that. So I have been. How did you like it?
Yeah, I probably only spent maybe 15 hours in Reno. We kind of like got there, and I went straight to the poker. Emily just like dropped me off at the poker room at the Peppermill, and I went in and played. I had called ahead to put my name on the wait list, and was able to get a seat right away. And yeah, it was not like the place is very cushy. It may be a little bit dark for my taste, and the ceilings are a touch low, but that's about the only bad thing I could say about it. I mean, overall, it has a very nice feel to it. It definitely feels more upscale than most Las Vegas casino, or like a more comfortable upscale. Like, I don't really care for the aesthetic of the Bellagio or the... I kind of like the Aria, but some of those places just feel too like over the top and weird to me. So the Peppermill, I kind of like the overall vibe of that place. So I was pretty favorably impressed with just the decor of the casino in general. All the floor people were really nice and welcoming, which I think I've talked about this on the show before, but I'm always concerned if I show up at a casino where I don't play regularly in terms of, you know, is there going to be favoritism towards the regulars, or just like how welcoming are people going to be? And I guess this probably is a casino that relies more on tourism business than some do, but everybody there was real friendly. I did recognize, and it's getting funny now how often this happens, like any poker room in the country I walk into, it turns out I see somebody I've played with before. Even if I don't know them by name, I'm like, oh, I've definitely played with that guy before. So I did recognize a couple of people who are playing in the games, but I played for about 5 hours and had a nice experience playing. They were pretty generous with I got a nice meal comped, which is better than usually I feel like I have to put in two long sessions before I get a free meal with whatever comps I'm earning at the table. I had a nice experience. I didn't really get to see too much of Reno other than the poker room. We did a quick drive around downtown, but it seems like on Saturday nights they close off the main downtown strip. You know, it's only pedestrian traffic, so we couldn't see a whole lot driving around by car. But yeah, it seemed like a neat little place. And the drive there from California is beautiful. But the hand that I played there that I thought I might share was sort of interesting. And this was the other cool thing. So the 5-10 game was uncapped. And when I got there, I just like checked in at the front desk of the poker room, and they asked me before I'd been seated, like, how many chips do you want? And so I asked, what's the maximum? And they said, it's uncapped. So I started to say 3,000. And then I was like, no, you know what? Make it 4,000. And I got to the table, and like, really, even 4,000, like, it was not overkill at all. Like, well, quite a few people had a lot of money on the table. And you are allowed to straddle from, I think you can straddle from any position for any amount that you want in that game. That we didn't have anybody doing anything crazy, but there was a fair amount of, like, you know, $20 button cutoff straddling going on. So the game was playing quite big, and there were some people who, even if they weren't terrible poker players, you know, they didn't. I think that their game was not optimized for very deep stacked play. So I had one hand that I played, I think, pretty differently from how I would ordinarily play this, and it worked out. I mean, there's a heavy element of luck involved in how it worked out for me, but I think it was sort of an interesting hand. So the under the gun player who had been extremely active and raising, just had a very wide range for making an overly large preflop raise, opens under the gun to 50. And so ordinarily I'm going to give some respect to someone who's opening 5x under the gun. But this particular player had been doing it enough that he could have like a much worse hand than most people would have for opening under the gun. So he opens 5x and I'm next to act with 10-8 suited, which again, like, not ordinarily a hand that I love calling a raise with in early position. And in a more aggressive game where there's a danger of somebody squeezing preflop, which this is a great squeezing spot, by the way. So like squeezing preflop, or even just, you know, people overcalling and using their position well post-flop, this really is not generally a call I'm going to make. But with the stacks being as deep as they are, knowing that a lot of these people are making deep stack mistakes and that I don't think there's going to be a lot of real aggressive squeezing, I did elect to call here. Does that sound reasonable? I mean, assuming we're talking like 400 big blind effective stacks.
I think that's right. I wouldn't call with 10-8 offsuit.
No, I wouldn't even consider that.
Or with 10-7 suited. So that's, I think this is close to the worst hand I would call with. I would probably default to folding, but I'll not be in default state pretty well. So if I think I got a beat on the guy, like if I feel sort of tuned in and if I think I sort of understand what he's thinking and what he's doing, then I'll call. So that'll happen pretty often. I think it's a default fold for me, but I don't think it's a bad call.
That's basically where I was.
Yeah,
I had very specific reasons for calling. It's not a call I would often recommend people to make, and definitely like even in the same game, if we only have 200 big blinds, I'm probably not calling.
Yeah,
I was just gonna ask how likely. How often do you expect people behind you to also come in with position on you?
Very often. I think there's going to be a lot of calling behind. So the big sizing. The big sizing is not driving anybody away, which is, I think, part of the reason why he's using big opening sizes. Not that he has a strong opening range, but it's just like, yeah, people are calling big raises. And the big blind is like 100%. Like, I don't think the big blind is ever folding. Not that he's going to have position on me, but the player who is in the big blind is just never folding. And that I think a lot of the other people, like, there's just a very good chance this pot is going to go 5 or 6 ways to the flop, which, you know, I have a hand that I'd rather have position, but I do have a hand that'll play well multi-way. So this is not like, I would probably 3-bet ace-jack offsuit, just given how wide this player's opening range is. But it's like, I wouldn't be cold calling here with a hand that didn't play well multi-way. You know, I'm either going to 3-bet or fold if I have a hand like ace-jack offsuit.
Why is calling better than 3-betting in this spot?
It might not be. That's a very good question, and it might be better off just knowing that this player is opening too wide in early position. I might be better off just 3-betting him immediately. And I do think a lot of people kind of overestimate implied odds calls, and that's why I emphasize that here, even the difference between 400 and 200 big blind effective stacks is pretty important, or knowing that a lot of people, you know, do actually cover me even though I have 400 big blinds. So, like, we really are talking about some pretty huge implied odds. Not just a matter of, like, if I'm going to get a 10-8-4 flop and get stacks in, but just being able to outplay people in general as a result of having deep stacks and, you know, possibly recognizing a good bluffing spot or et cetera. I think that I kind of want, like, the situations that I'm looking for are situations that are going to come up in multi-way, extremely deep stacked sort of situations. And you know, there may be some value in just 3-betting this right away, but there's enough hands that I want to 3-bet that don't play well multi-way that I think I'd rather... I just think that the spots that are going to come up post-flop when I call are probably more profitable than 3-betting, but I do think there's a chance I'm wrong about that, and I might just be better off 3-betting immediately. But I mean, that's a lot of exposure to have. Yes. If I 3-bet, I'm probably going to make it like 130. So that's a lot of exposure to have already put $130 in the pot with 10 high and 7 people still to act behind me. Like, none of those people are folding pocket nines or better. None of those people are folding ace queen. So, you know, I am going to get called and, you know, put in money from pretty substantially behind. I'm going to be putting $130 in from pretty far behind a fair amount of the time.
Okay.
Okay, so I call with the 10-8 suited. We end up only getting 2 other callers. I think the small blind and the big blind call up, actually. So I did end up having effective position here, which is not something I was counting on, which was very nice. So the small blind and the big blind call. And we end up going, so $200 in the pot. We go to the flop, and the flop is 5-6-7 rainbow. So this is a pretty great flop for me, in the sense that I've got the open-ended straight draw, and the 9 is a real gin card for me because it's going to mean that I have the nuts when someone else has the second nuts, especially in like a 4-way pot. So
do you have a backdoor flush draw?
I do not.
Okay.
That's how bad I run. 3 flush draws on the flop and I So it checks to the preflop raiser. He bets 100 into 200. And this is another thing. You know, for most of the time, the advice that I give people is you should be thinking of your draws as bluffing hands first. And so I have this player making a pretty weak bet, I think, like only betting 100 into 200. I think you could make that bet in a balanced way, but I don't think this player is. Like, I think that bet is just like a sign of weakness, and I think raising now and continuing to barrel is going to be profitable. And so that was my first instinct, was like, hey, you've got a good draw. This player is clearly, you know, not nutted. So raise him and go to war. And I think that is how I would play if I just had an eight, if I had, ace eight suited, for instance, especially with a backdoor flush draw, that probably is what I would do. But the fact that I had, you know, that the nine was such a gin card for me made me want to just call now instead and hope that someone behind me is going to overcall with an eight. And I'm not giving up the possibility of bluffing on a later straight, but I thought I might be better off not running the bluff immediately, not pulling the trigger on that immediately, and seeing if I can set up that great situation of catching somebody else holding an eight when the turn is exactly a nine, which, you know, granted, it's a very specific situation, but as I said, I'm not forfeiting the opportunity to bluff later, and it's such a profitable situation when we're this deep, and I know that these people are going to overvalue, like that they're just going to like automatically stack off with the second nuts. I think there is value in trying to set up that situation, even though it won't come up very frequently.
It's going to happen 8% of the time, which is not insignificant.
Yeah,
especially given, I mean, if you're assuming the implied odds are like 300 big blinds 8% of the time, like that adds up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 8% of the time times the time that you catch somebody else with an eight, which is much less than that. But
yeah.
I mean, I think that matters a lot. And I also want to point out that sort of less valuable when it happens, but something that will happen sometimes is somebody has like 5-3 suited, or even given the big blinds description, like 6-3 or 7-3 suited, or even 5-3 offsuit, and peels the flop when he would have folded. So then even the 4 becomes an implied odds card for you, because people will show up with 3s, and you will see people peeling this flop with hands like pocket 3s or suited hands that have a 3. And or like they have 5-4, then they turn 2 pair, and they convince themselves that you're bluffing, or you have pocket 10s. I think even when there's a 4 liner on the board and you just have the 8, I think you have some implied odds in that spot too.
So I do just call, and this ends up playing out just perfectly for me. So I call, both of the blinds call, and the turn is the 9 of hearts. So there are now 2 hearts on the board, but, yeah, very, very bink. And with both of the blinds calling, I think there's a very, very good chance somebody else has an eight. I mean, the preflop raiser could have one. He's actually a somewhat better player than the two players. Like, the two players in the blinds are just like guaranteed to go off for stacks if they have an eight. The under the gun raiser might have a little more sense to at least like not raise with an eight. But so everyone checks to me, and I bet 300 into 600. It's kind of expecting that, you know, if no one has an eight, I'm not going to be able to play a huge pot, but if someone does have an eight, I think there's a good chance one of the players in the blinds will raise with an eight, which is I think I can get away with not making a huge turn bet, even though there's a lot of money behind. There's like $3,800 behind or something, but I don't think I have to make a huge bet on the turn in order to get stacks in when somebody else has the second nuts. So I bet 300, and sure enough, the small blind check raises me to 1,000, and I move all in, and she happily calls me. She actually did have an eight with 2 hearts, so she was not drawing dead. I'm in very good shape there, but she did not. I mean, I don't know if she would have raised me. My guess is that she would have raised me even without the flush draw, but she did actually have a flush draw to go along with her eight, so she probably thought that she was free rolling me until she saw my hand, but I did end up winning that pot. So, I mean, it was... I don't want to be too results oriented here, but I do think it's a good example. And I mean, it was nice that it actually worked out, because I was kind of betting on a low frequency situation that would be very profitable coming along. But I did end up playing the hand in a pretty different way than I ordinarily would, because of how deep we were and because of some specific mistakes that I thought these players were going to make.
Nice. So you made enough money to pay my expenses for 6 months.
And well, Carlos, I wanted to ask you, because I know you were talking on Twitter yesterday about having some trouble with the GTO chapter in the Expert Nolan Hold'em book.
Yeah, I think it was mainly the way that the author writes. Like, I kind of had the feeling, like, as I was reading it, I felt like he was building towards a point, and it was taking too long, and I found myself thinking in my head, get to the point, get to the point. And then, like, the point either never came, or when I got, or when we got to the point, it was like, is that all you were saying? You know, I felt like, when I sent the tweet out, I kind of felt like the tone came across as me being dismissive of GTO, and that wasn't the case. It was just that I felt like other people have explained it a lot better, and this one was like a little bit more heady than it needed to be.
So this is a chapter that that Will Tipton contributed to the Expert Nolan Holden book, which I actually haven't read. I mean, I've read both of Tipton's the books that he wrote himself, The Expert Heads Up Nolan and Holden, which I think are they're very good books, but yeah, they definitely are heady. I mean, I think they're kind of they're much more math intensive than and kind of theory intensive than even some other, like, what you might call GTO books. This definitely isn't Ed Miller.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's a good way of saying it. This book is Jonathan Little's Excelling at No Limit Hold'em.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was calling it Expert.
I kind of had the same thought that I've heard other people say about Scalancy's old writings. It's like, I felt like a lot of times he would focus on things that were so, like, unlikely to happen that I'm thinking, why are we even focusing on this? Like, there's one line in the book that says a GTO strategy can involve folding the nuts even on the river. And I'm thinking, why are we even talking about that? I felt like, you know, why should we even be talking about that? And then he was like talking about the definition of the word game and the definition of the word strategy. And I'm thinking, this is just drawn out, long, drawn out paragraph about stuff that, in my opinion, and maybe it's, you know, based on my intelligence level, but I'm thinking, so far, none of this shit is going to help me with poker. You know, tell me how to play better, you know. And there were one or two concepts in the chapter that I found valuable, but I think those things I kind of already knew, but I read the entire chapter, and at the end of it, I didn't learn anything new.
I don't know. What did you take away as the main point? Again, I haven't actually read the book, so I don't know what, you know, if he just had one chapter, like what he chose to say in that one chapter. I mean, but I guess your complaint was he didn't really have a point.
His main point was that GTO works best for, like, heads up play. It works a little bit less well for multi-table. Well, he calls it crowd player, which basically means multiplayer cash games. And he says that it doesn't work well at all for tournament play due to ICM. And I'm thinking, I kind of already knew most of that stuff. And his build up to explaining that just felt like it was unnecessarily wordy and heady. And then he did, like, some EV calculations, which I think is something that is tough for a lot of people. But I've done those before, and I've seen that topic tackled better in other books. Then he has, like, a huge, like, decision tree, kind of like what's the Card Runner's EV. Mm-hmm. So your video explained it a lot better. Your video on TBE explained, you know, decision tree is a lot better than this chapter, in my opinion. And then at the end, he did, like, some type of toy game. That was probably, like, the best part of the chapter was the toy game thing. It's kind of like the ABC game, but it's PVBC. You're probably familiar with that.
Yeah, the polarized range versus bluff catcher.
Right, right. That was, to me, the most valuable part of the chapter, but because I've been studying poker for a while now, I was already familiar with that information. So I'm not saying that it wouldn't be valuable to some people, but just for me, it wasn't. And even if somebody didn't already know the stuff that I already knew, I feel like that person would have a harder time understanding it because of the drawn out way he explains things.
Yeah, I mean, my take from reading Expert Heads Up was that, you know, he's so, I mean, first off, I think just in terms of how well he covers important concepts in game theory, it's much, much better than my series on Tournament Poker Edge. Part of it is, like, there are probably things that I would, like, I hadn't read that book as of the time that I did that series for TPE, and I think there are some things that I would do differently if I, you know, now having read Tipton's book and a few other things and understanding those concepts even better than I do. But, you know, part of my goal there was to kind of present it in a somewhat, like, practical way in terms of how can you actually use concepts from game theory to make decisions, which is not really
that's what I wanted.
Yeah. And so, I mean, he's more theory oriented generally in terms of, like, if you really, and I mean, ultimately the goal is still to do something practical, but it's like, if you can really understand these kinds of common situations or dynamics or whatever. So, like, the polarized range versus bluff catcher is a dynamic that comes up a lot in poker. And so recognizing when you're in that situation and then knowing how to play it really, really well is a pretty valuable thing. So, you know, I kind of get the value of that. And the major thing I think that is kind of a mistake that I make in that series in terms of how I present things, and something that I think he did a good job of explaining. Like, I mean, I knew it wasn't 100% accurate when I was doing it, but I kind of thought, like, well, it's at least a useful approximation. And he kind of essentially says it's not a useful approximation. I think he calls it, like, the naive indifference principle or something along those, just the idea of, like, well, you know, if you bet 100 into 200, your opponent has to call has to call at least 2/3 of the time, because you're risking 1 unit to win 2 units. So, you know, if he wants to make you indifferent to bluffing, he has to call 1/3 of the time, he has to continue 2/3 of the time, which, you know, really your choice, like, that assumes that whatever hand you're bluffing with has 0% chance of winning as a result of checking. So in practice, most hands have at least some chance. Some hands have a very good chance of winning after they check, which means that your opponent doesn't actually have to defend quite that frequently against your bets, especially if you're getting to a certain street with a range where, you know, you're not really going to have complete air balls. They don't really have to defend anywhere near that frequently. And quite often, like, your indifference decisions are a good deal more complicated than just make sure you're defending this particular fraction of the time. And I do think that fraction is still useful for, I mean, you can't figure out all those things in real time. So I think, like, having that fraction in the back of your head and, like, knowing what it's costing your opponent to bluff is something worth thinking about. But I think he, at least in his Expert Heads Up No Limit books, I think he explains the concept of indifference with a lot more precision. And I think it's important precision. It's not just like, he's a little bit more precise, but he's harder to understand. Like, I think it's a pretty important point that,
I'm glad somebody finally got you to recognize that point. I can't even count the number of times that I've tried to point that out to you. Fine, Will Tipton says it then. Fine, sure, now you believe him. In fairness, he was explaining it a lot better than I was. I will say that the other reason that the naive indifference principle doesn't work is that it assumes that you can effectively defend against your opponent, whereas sometimes there are times when a card just promotes your opponent to having a range that you can't really stop, and you just have to give him an auto profit because anything else you do is worse. But so that's another problem with naive indifference. I'm glad you've seen the light, and I'm glad that somebody explained it articulately enough and understood it better than I do. So
I'll say that a lot of the stuff that I read in his book, some of the same concepts I learned through Matt John's book, and I felt like John covered it a lot better, and even in a more practical way, in my opinion. And it's kind of funny that I think Will Tipton kind of understood the way a lot of people would view it, because the last sentence of his introduction to the chapter is, "I promise to cover a practical skill or two as well." So I think he kind of felt like a lot of people wouldn't get it, or it would be, you know, urging him to get to the point. But again, that's probably just a lack of understanding on my part. And it's also not an indictment on the book as a whole. I really like the book. It's just this one particular chapter I had trouble with.
Makes sense. For whatever it's worth, I would recommend Tipton over Janda, but it's useful to get your view of this.
Maybe I should just read his book. That's probably what I need to do.
Yeah, I can't vouch for this particular chapter, but I do think his books are tough going, but they contain stuff that is not anywhere else.
How would you compare it to Mathematics of Poker?
Well, you know, Mathematics of Poker is like at an even higher theoretical level, where they're not even talking about any specific actual poker game for the most part. They're talking about like the toy games, and I mean, Janda is actually trying to solve certain heads up, no limit situations, or, you know, given a pretty non-controversial set of starting assumptions, I guess. But he's really trying to. So in some sense, it's kind of unfair to call him not practical, because he's sort of the most practical of them. It's just that, like, trying to solve them with extreme precision means, like, you get into a lot of details.
Gotcha. Ed Miller's 1% for the win. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the simplest to understand, but it leaves a lot on the table in terms of precision, as with my range construction series on Tournament Poker Edge. You know, I think they both suffer from that problem of, like, they're sacrificing a lot of precision for the sake of being a little bit easier to understand and easier to apply immediately.
Yeah. Of the three of us, I'm a proud member of the dumb masses. So I need to be dumbed down a bit for me, and thank you for that, Ed.
but it's also a matter of what your goals are. Like, you say that you're going to be resistant to moving up too much because you would rather win more consistently, and you would rather beat the snot out of a smaller game, even if it means losing a few dollars of EV.
Right.
And for those games, like, getting really good at certain fundamental things and certain exploitive things is going to get you the money. And this was almost exactly my attitude for a long time. And to some extent it still is, but now I'm trying to move up a little bit and trying to raise my game to, like, the next level. But like, if I had your goals, I would study Ed Miller, I would play a lot, I would study spots from $50 tournaments, you know, like, I think that's if you want to turn poker knowledge into money, I think that's your best strategy. So I think you're pursuing your goals very effectively.
That's very true and very well said.
Great to talk to you, Carlos. Thanks for answering my questions on Twitch. Yeah, I appreciate that. And happy. Good luck with everything.
Thank you. If you ever decide to take the van all the way across the country, San Francisco, like I said, is pretty van friendly.
You know what? I think I will do that. I'm considering driving it to Vegas next year.
I don't know why you would.
Yeah, if the it's a $3,000 van. So if the engine doesn't explode in Dallas, if I can make it to, like, Dallas, and if I still have an engine at that point, I think I'm gonna drive to Vegas like that. I think I'm gonna get a lot of good fodder for writing articles and Twitch videos, and, you know, a lot of good stuff to write about if I do that.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a bunch of little casinos between, but I don't know, if you go the southerly route, I guess you go through, like, Mississippi. Yeah, I mean, you'd have the opportunity to stop at a bunch of little casinos along the way, and they're not all of them little, but, you know, casinos that don't make as many headlines as Foxwoods or Las Vegas, and you'd probably enjoy that element of it.
That's actually what I'm going to do for the rest of this year, is just go on, like, a southeastern tour of, like, WSOB circuit events and, like, Heartland Poker Tour events, like, in Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. I'm just going to travel to all these states and basically play single table satellites and Twitch on location from, like, so next month, the first one is going to be at West Palm Beach in Florida. So I'll be on the beach and twitching from the beach. So I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. So we should leave this in the episode after all, because that's good information, and that certainly makes me want to follow you more closely than I've been doing.
Yeah. And tell okay. me where you're going. Tell me where you're going. I might meet you at one or two of these places.
So let me look at my calendar. I know. so I've planned all this stuff out, man. So September 17th will be West Palm Beach, the WSOP circuit stop. October 1st is the Heartland Poker Tour in Daytona, Florida. October 9th is HPT Vicksburg, which I think is Mississippi.
Yeah, I've been to Vicksburg, actually. That's an interesting little place.
So that'll be October 9th.
A lot of Civil War history there.
Yeah, yeah. November 12th will be... No, that's in Vegas. I'm not going to Vegas. Well, maybe. It depends on how these other stops go. But the one I'm looking... most forward to is November 26th will be the circuit stop in Cherokee, North Carolina, because that's going to put me full circle. Like, this whole journey started with me going to Cherokee and sleeping in my truck, and now I've actually upgraded or downgraded to actually living in a vehicle from just camping in it for one night. So that is the schedule for the rest of the year.
Nice. Well, good luck with all that, and you know, with not getting hassled by the police and whatnot along the way. All the challenges that you're anticipating. You know, best of luck in weathering those storms.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good day, and have a good trip, Andrew.
Thanks. Of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.